Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from the Berlin-based Think and Do Tank Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy and security. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayer.
And I'm Alexandra Steinkraus. In this series, you will hear from experts and practitioners offering their take on climate foreign policy, climate-related impacts to security, and promoting peace and resilience in a changing climate. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow at climatediplo on Twitter. Hello to our listeners. We hope you've had a good start to 2024. Welcome to our first podcast episode of the new year, where we'll be discussing climate security challenges in Haiti and what to do about them. This month, we're lucky to be joined by three guests to discuss the linkages between climate, peace, and security in Haiti, and how to integrate climate change adaptation and environmental protection with peace-building measures. Our first guest is Paul Junot. She's an environmental law specialist and mediator at UNEP Haiti.
Hello, everyone. Hello, Alex. Hello, colleagues. I'm so happy to be here with you today. Thank you for having me.
Welcome. And then Beatrice Mosello is a senior advisor on climate diplomacy and security at Adelphi and was the lead author of the Roots for Peace study.
Hi, everyone. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And then Jessica Hsu is an anthropologist, an independent researcher based in Haiti, and conducted interviews in Haiti that informed the study.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me. It's really great to be here.
Welcome to all three of you. Really excited to start off the year with this podcast episode. So to start us off, let's set the stage a little bit. Haiti is considered the most vulnerable country in Latin America and the Caribbean to climate change, and is also in the midst of a deep security, political, and humanitarian crisis. A little bit later in the episode, we're going to dive a bit deeper into how the impacts of climate change are compounding insecurity in Haiti and also contributing to violence and conflicts and some of the specifics of the study. But Jessica, could you start us off by describing some of the realities that Haitians are experiencing on a daily basis?
Where we can start is that the impacts are very different between the rural and the urban regions, ultimately very much interlinked. But maybe what we'll do is start with the impacts in the rural regions. What's happening is in the countryside, what we've been told by a lot of farmers and people that live in the countryside during our interviews was that the rainy season has really been changing. And what it's being called is clima desode, not exactly climate change, but this unpredictability of the climate, which is what we're being told repeatedly. And so it becomes really difficult for people to plant using traditional methods. People have been shifting away from agriculture, moving into cities in order to what is being called chercher la vie, in search of livelihoods. And so there is just not the ability to make as much money. So people need to look for other livelihoods, largely moving into the cities. And then going into the cities, a lot of people that migrate land in popular neighborhoods, which are generally the most marginalized. And in these neighborhoods, we've had interviewees, like, for example, in City Soleil, one of our interviewees said that the insecurity is constant. A day doesn't pass where somebody doesn't die or specifically isn't killed. And there is that migration into the big cities, but also out migration out of Haiti, which is also in order to search for livelihoods. So in neighborhoods such as City Soleil, in addition to the violence that people experience every day, there is an issue of waste management. So there are canals that run through City Soleil, and a lot of people that we interviewed from these neighborhoods talked about trash as being a real problem, especially when it rains, because the rain goes downhill through the canals, overflowing the canals with water and trash into people's homes. So it's another element that people need to deal with. One of the other impacts in the provinces, in the rural region that we see, is there are a lot more disasters in terms of hurricanes and earthquakes that are impacting the rural regions. And one of the things that we were told in our interviews is when there's a hurricane or an earthquake, you know, generally, historically, the backup in terms of capital have been agroforestry, trees such as mangoes and avocados and whatnot, or livestock. For, you know, a lot of the people we interviewed from the countryside talked about livestock as being savings banks, savings accounts. And so when, for example, some Hurricane Matthew hits, 90% of the livestock were killed, which means that the savings accounts are completely depleted and no longer is there the social capital that exist prior to these disasters. So impoverishing communities. I think those are probably the major impacts. And I can touch on more of those a little bit later.
Thanks very much for sharing some of these realities and getting us started, kind of setting the stage. So now let's talk a little bit about the conception of the study. And the study was developed in close collaboration and consultation with UNEP, UNDP, the Ministry of Environment of Haiti, the Climate Security Mechanism, as well as the Climate Security Working Group in Haiti. So then, Paula, maybe next we can talk a little bit about how all of these different actors came together and how the vision for the study was realized.
Yes, of course. Let me get back to how it all started. So as you probably all know, the UN can address climate changes as part of its general response to conflict situations through inclusion in peacekeeping missions. It has done so notably in Lake Chad, Somalia, West Africa, the Sahel, Mali, and Darfur. So in June 2021, during a session of the UN Security Council on Haiti, Norway specifically requested that a UN mission in Haiti, the Bureau Intégré des Nations Unies en Haïti, address the links between insecurity and climate change. Norway said that it would like to emphasize the need to consider the impact of climate change as one of several systemic challenges that Haiti is facing, emphasizing that Haiti is particularly vulnerable to natural disasters exacerbated by climate change and environmental degradation, and that lack of resilience affects livelihoods and leads to internal displacement, which in turn fuels crime and unrest, all contributing to deteriorating humanitarian situation. So UNEP with the Ministry of Environment of Haiti and the Climate Security Mechanism in New York decided to commend an introductory study on climate security to inform BINU on the effects of climate change on the already serious insecurity problem in Haiti. As you know, the Climate Security Mechanism is an association of the Departments of Political and Peacebuilding Affairs and Peace Operations, UNDP and UNEP, which aims to strengthen the capacity of the UN and its partners to systematically analyze and address the linkages between climate change, peace, and security. So with the support of the CSM and with the Ministry of Environment, we reached out to a few other UN agencies, UNDP, World Food Programme, and IOM, to see if they would be willing to participate and perhaps co-finance this study. However, as soon as the word was out at the UN country team meeting, all of the other UN agencies in Haiti raised their hand to participate to the initiative. This was also discussed at a meeting of the financial and technical partners, and soon enough, IADB, Switzerland, Mexico, and France expressed also their interest in joining the effort. Then OCHA sent an email to the humanitarian organizations, and then about 13 organizations came forward to participate. The Ministry of Environment, on its part, was responsible for the mobilization of the government institutions. So four or five institutions came forth. And a few months later in the process, we welcomed the our civil society platform on climate change, which regroups about 60 civil society organizations. So this is how the Climate Security Group was created in 2022. And this shows how this issue of climate change and security is a common concern for all in Haiti. As was mentioned, there are now in between 60 to 90 organizations that are members of the group, which makes it a very inclusive coalition mobilizing all spheres of the Haitian society. The group even has its own logo now.
And as you've mentioned, this Climate Security Working Group is more than 60 different UN agencies, Haitian institutions, international organizations, and these Haitian civil society organizations. Now that kind of in our narrative picture of the process of the study, it's been established how everything came together. What did collaboration look like throughout the study?
The condition to be a member of the group was that each organization had to contribute something, whether financially, technically, or by liaising with the civil society for the investigations. So the group financed the study, approved the terms of references, and the contract was awarded to Adelphi after an independent procurement process hosted by UNDP. The members of the group also commented and approved the methodology, participated in the investigations, and of course, approved the report. So I always say that the peace building efforts started with the group because not all of these organizations have the same perspective or agree on the same agenda for Haiti. For example, some NGOs or civil society organizations are very critical about the historical positioning of the UN or some other international organizations with regards to Haiti, especially their support of the actual government, which is a self-proclaimed government. So there is clearly a lack of trust from the civil society organizations towards the UN of what is called the or the UN and what is called the core group of international organizations for many historical reasons. So it wasn't always easy to manage all these sometimes opposite views. But despite the differences, all these organizations have a common agenda, which is the environment, climate, and peace agenda. And this is the common ground that we started to build on. The report, I will say, was officially published in fall 2023. And I'm glad to say that it has been endorsed by all the members of the climate security group.
One very small question to you before we move forward and get into some of the findings of the study, but you've highlighted this process needing to get everyone on board in order to get these endorsements and in order to have the study. How long did this process actually take?
It was extremely short for such a study, in fact, because it took, I would say, about a little more than a year, which is not much because we started in June 2022 and the report was actually published in fall 2023. And this is taking into account the time of translation and editing of the report. Within a year, we, the group, actually succeeded in producing the study. And you have to remember also the extremely difficult context that we were living at the time in Haiti, which rendered all regional travel very difficult for the investigations. So I'd say that I'm very proud of the fact that we were quite efficient as a team to support Adelphi in doing the study and also point out the fantastic work that Adelphi has done in this very difficult context to be able to maneuver through all these events and all these complications and all these obstacles and actually deliver some results.
That's amazing that all of this was able to be mobilized in this kind of short amount of time. So now that we're at the study itself, it's time to come to you, Bea. So the study identifies 5 climate security risk pathways. Can you briefly walk us through these pathways and why existing institutional and policy, international and local responses haven't been able to overcome some of these identified challenges yet?
Sure, Alex, thank you so much for the question. And maybe before I answer that, let me also thank Paul for the kind words with respect to the study. It's totally reciprocal that realizing the study in collaboration with the Climate Security Working Group, this incredibly dynamic group of experts, has been a wonderful and exciting and unique experience. But yes, let's get to what we actually found out in our study. I think a lot of the dynamics set in motion by the impacts of climate change have already been very eloquently illustrated by Jessica in her previous intervention. Maybe what I'm going to focus on here now is to try and shed light on what are the implications of these impacts on security dynamics in the country. And I think it's important here to specify that by security, we don't mean necessarily just kind of violence and conflict and gang violence in the country, but we understood and understand security in a more comprehensive way. So talking about physical security of people, but also food security, water security, health. So a more really comprehensive understanding. I think a first kind of dynamic that we've seen in our study kind of relates to the impacts of climate change in terms of extreme weather events, right? So we already know that Haiti is extremely vulnerable to hurricanes, storms. We've seen plenty of examples in the past. And if we look at climate projections, we know that these will become more frequent and also more intense in the future. And what we're already seeing is that Haiti does have a system for disaster risk management, one that's also been quite strengthened after the earthquake of 2010, but there are significant gaps in terms of the capacity of this them to be implemented and to operate when our extreme weather event happens. This means that, of course, Haitians lose their lives, lose their livelihoods. The infrastructure, communication, road is extremely exposed to the risk of disasters when we have these extreme weather events happening. And because these are happening more and more frequently, it also means that people cannot recover from one disaster to the other. And this is really kind of contributing to plunging the country into people into extreme poverty, really leaving people in some parts of the country fighting for their survival. And also what we've seen is that especially those people that are already living in margins, for example, people with mobility issues, people living in slums, subsistence-based laborers, are those that are really left to manage the consequences of disasters when they happen on their own. Also, and again, Jessica already talked a bit about this, what we've seen is that a lot of Haitians, especially in rural areas, live on agriculture, livestock and fishery, and these are all activities that we know are extremely vulnerable or exposed to the impacts of climate change. Obviously, extreme weather events, but also slower onset changes like altered rainfall patterns, warmer temperatures. So as people lose their livelihoods, what we've seen is that some are recurring to harmful coping mechanisms. For example, we see more and more farmers using slash and burn techniques or clearing forest areas for farming and grazing or cutting down trees to make charcoal in an unsustainable manner. And these practices worsen deforestation, soil degradation, coastal erosion. So eventually they make the impact of extreme weather events when they happen even worse. And in some instances, what we've seen is that also some of the coping strategies may lead to conflict. So farmers, for example, have left their lands and moved towards the coast for fishing, but they don't have the required experience. And so they have, in some cases, entered into conflict or tensions with local fisher folks who are already coping with dwindling fish stocks. And this, in some cases, has led to real instances of conflict. Another coping mechanism is that of people moving out of the areas where they are and where their livelihoods are no longer sustainable. Most of them go to cities, particularly the capital, Port-au-Prince. And there, this has been happening for decades. In the capital and in other cities, there's been very little urban planning happening, which means that people have settled down in slums, the so-called bidonville, which have come to represent pockets of extreme vulnerability to poverty. They're overcrowded, characterized by poor water, hygiene and sanitation conditions, which create environmental hazards. Again, Jessica spoke about them before, and really heighten also the risk of diseases spreading. And just last year, there was a cholera epidemic that broke out in the slum of Cité Soleil due to poor sewage and consumption of contaminated water. The fact that people move to Port-au-Prince and can't find jobs means that especially young people moving out of impoverished rural areas to seek a better life in cities find themselves confronted with joining gangs. It's really one of the only opportunities they have to make a living. We should also remember that in a lot of these contexts, education opportunities are lacking. And really the risk is that we're having a lost generation of kids growing up without real positive role models and having known only poverty and violence. So Jessica mentioned some people also recur to international migration. So try to go to the Dominican Republic, to the US, to other countries in Latin America. And this is nothing new in Haiti. We've seen this for decades. And actually remittances and investments from the diaspora have been important kind of economic mechanisms for the growth of the country. But we're seeing this happening more and more frequently, also through illegal routes, which of course puts people at risk. But also what we've seen through the is that this is causing the erosion of social cohesion mechanisms between communities, especially in urban areas, but increasingly so also in rural areas. And in a country like Haiti, where community aid practices have been always a key mechanism for which people have coped, have gone through difficult times, families, neighborhoods, neighbors helping each other, the loss of social cohesion clearly has some important implication on how able are people to cope. So these are the kind of key mechanisms and key dynamics that we've seen at play. I think one of the key mechanisms that we've seen is that because these challenges are compounding each other and climate change is adding an extra layer of challenges, existing policies and institutions, which were already weakened by political, security, and economic challenges, are simply not able to cope or to face. But also to bring a positive note here is that we've also seen that despite all these challenges, government authorities and international agencies that are active in Haiti have been extremely reactive to the findings of our report, and Paul already mentioned this, and are really thinking about how to invest in strategies and resources to address these issues in a more integrated and inclusive way. And also, Haiti has an incredibly vibrant civil society, and at the local level, we're seeing some really amazing work, for example, on restoring and protecting the natural environment, as well as peace building work happening with young people in difficult neighborhoods of the capital city. So there's a lot to build on already. And I'll stop here.
Thanks so much, Bea, for outlining some of these ways that the impacts of climate change are compounding insecurity in Haiti, from hindering responses and prevention efforts of the government to pushing people towards harmful adaptation practices, changing migration, kind of undermining social cohesion. And one of the things that has been mentioned kind of over the course that we've been discussing is also the difficult context and working in Haiti. And of course, you and some of your co-authors weren't able to actually travel there, which really highlights the importance, especially of the interviews that Jessica conducted. I think for people who have looked at the study, interviews with different people in Haiti, different groups of people, are one of the really prominent things that are featured. So Jessica, when conducting some of these interviews for the study, I'm curious if there are any insights that were shared that surprised you, and if you can share any specific experiences that really stood out.
So in terms of if there's anything shocking, I would say not necessarily shocking, but the study and interviewing different people from different regions really reinforced the ties between rural and urban, and specifically agricultural production, the impacts of climate change and agricultural production, migration, and insecurity in the cities. So I'd say that is the linkage that was reinforced through a lot of this. There's a lot of assumption that there's those ties, but in conversation, it really reinforced the ties between the rural and urban and the drivers of insecurity. One of the interviews was from a woman in Abrico, and it really struck me because this woman is in a position where she has a formal job, which is rare. Many people function in informal settings, are doing commerce and other things. And so in this situation, you would expect that she is perhaps better off than other people, right? In that sense, and her husband is a farmer. She was talking about how difficult it is for her husband to plant because of the changing season. So there is not that supplemental income or necessarily food for the family. But in addition, she was running a women's group that was doing embroidery and selling. And that really, due to the insecurity, not being able to purchase materials or get them into the big cities to sell, and also women having to look, do other things in order to manage their lives for their children's schooling and other things, the group had sort of dissipated. And she actually had left Haiti and migrated to Florida. And she's there without papers. And she has, I think it's 8 kids, all of them with university degrees, from engineers to agronomists to nurses. And not a single one is able to find a job.
Thanks very much for sharing. And now, speaking of these interviews and taking the experiences of people who are living in Haiti and who also have been living in Haiti but have been forced to migrate elsewhere, Beatrice, can you walk us through a little bit how these interviews informed the study itself? And also, as we start to kind of look at the end of our time talking together today, some of the key recommendations of the study.
Of course, Alex. And thanks for the question. As a researcher, I'm always happy to jump on the opportunity to throw a couple of words in on methodology. Yes, as you mentioned, to inform our study, we conducted more than 30 interviews and consultations with Haitian and international experts, including most of them part actually of the climate security working group. So working with the group has been a very key part of the study. Again, as you said before, that kind of substitute, like made up for the fact that we couldn't travel ourselves to Haiti, but in a way it was so much better like this because we could build on the experience of people that are working directly in the context and that come from there and have the experience of the issues we're talking about that obviously we don't have not being based there. So this was really key for us to make sure that we had a good understanding of the key environmental, political, economic, security dynamics of Haiti. But also through Jessica and a number of Haitian organizations, also member of the group, we were able to hear the voices of people in Haiti. And this is a core pillar of the methodology that we use for the study that builds on the weathering risk methodology as well as the climate security mechanism methodology. And it's really axed around the importance of getting the voices and experiences of as many people as we can, from young adults living in slum areas in the capital of Port-au-Prince, affected by gang violence, to male, female farmers in the more rural areas of the country, people with disabilities having been affected by extreme weather events, for example, people that have tried to leave Haiti and have been sent back, etc. Also, maybe interesting to note that this approach that we took also affected the way in which we wrote the report. That is a bit less of an academic endeavor, if you want, especially the part where we talk about the climate security pathways. We try to write our analysis that really using quotes from our interviews to allow the people to tell their stories as much as possible directly in the report. So it's in this way, through the expertise of the Climate Security Working Group, as well as reflecting on the experience of the people we talked to, that we were able to identify some entry points for addressing the complex climate and security dynamics in Haiti. The underlying assumption to the actions that we recommended is that without understanding and addressing the role that climate, as well as the environmental factors, play in impacting and exacerbating pre-existing political, security, economic, humanitarian challenges, the situation is only set to worsen. So knowing that, and based on this assumption, based on this reality, our report recommends a new approach to tackling the spiraling crisis in Haiti. Yes, we need to restore security, we need to restore political stability, but we also need to invest to ensure that people can make a living in Haiti, can access natural resources, can access basic services, can access education and health, can have a decent life, because that's what it all amounts to in the end. And the new approach that we recommend comprises actions around four areas. So to begin with, we need a Haitian-led high-level vision established through multi-sectoral dialogue that puts the protection and restoration of the environment and climate change adaptation at the center of all economic, political, and social decisions driving the country forward. We need to look at the centralized responses to implement this vision that come from and are implemented by empowered local communities and organizations. We need programs that explicitly aim at rebuilding the link between Haitians and the natural environment, using this as an entry point to tackle broader insecurity and violence dynamics, so with a very strong peace-building component. And lastly, and very timely, given the discussions that are happening on the international stage, at COP28, now at the World Bank Fragility Forum that will come up in a couple of weeks, we need multilateral and bilateral donors to increase and target funding to address climate and conflict challenges together, including in fragile contexts like Haiti. And this alone would be a whole new episode for a podcast, so I'll just stop here for now.
Perfect. Maybe it'll be a stay tuned eventually for a follow-up on climate finance in these kinds of contexts. But I guess for the sake of this episode, it is properly time to wrap it up. So for these recommendations, I think the note that we'll leave off is the role of different actors. So then, Paula, Jessica, if you could leave us, let's go to Paula, you first. How will the Climate Security Working Group continue to drive this forward within Haiti? And specifically, kind of speaking to Beatrice's last point, what role do international donors play in addressing these climate security challenges?
The next step of the Climate Security Group will be the implementation of the recommendations of our study. So as an example, the report of the study recommends building a high-level vision through a multi-sectoral dialogue. So one of the objectives of the Haiti government, supported by the Climate Security Group, is to build a policy dialogue that could lead to the adoption of a national policy on climate security. The Climate Security Group will then act as an expert in this process of adopting and implementing this climate security policy at national level. Another example are some initiatives for the reintegration of migrants through nature-based solutions that are led by IOM with the support of UNEP and FAO, and which will inform the Climate Security Group also, and PBF initiative, which is led by UNEP and aims to maintain peace and security and reduce conflict and insecurity and migration among young people by using nature-based solutions as a vector of dialogue and socioeconomic stabilization. But both projects address one of the main research axes of the climate security study, namely the increase in the vulnerability of young people, and implement at least two of the study's recommendations on nature-based solutions and community empowerment. Those projects will inform the Climate Security Group, which in turn can provide expertise and recommendations. As for the role that international donors play, well, some people don't like the expression, but I would say it's a question of climate justice, because small island developing states such as Haiti are responsible for less than 1% of global greenhouse gas emissions, but are affected more frequently by extreme weather events than the rest of the world, and also tend to suffer more from water scarcity, which are two challenges exacerbated by climate change. It's also a fact that in fragile and conflict-affected settings, extreme weather events affect 3 times as many people annually compared to other countries. And despite this, people living in extremely fragile states such as Haiti receive a fraction, up to 80 times less, of climate finance compared to non-fragile states. So it appears obvious that more financing must be directed to these countries, but we must ensure also that the funds actually reach the communities that most need it. This requires conflict and climate sensitive analysis, but also more flexibility and adaptability, because in these fragile countries like Haiti, the circumstances can change very quickly. So a project designed by experts 5 years beforehand might not deliver the expected results to the communities. And I would add that sustainability of the solutions also need to be addressed. And for this, a more, as the report of the study recommends, a more coordinated approach is needed between international donors, between the humanitarian and development organizations, to first avoid duplication of efforts, but also dispersion of funds, and also ensure sustainability of the initiatives. One last word on sustainability. You know, sometimes after 3 years of an activity or livelihoods are always closely related to peace and security. And sometimes in a project after 3, maybe 4, maybe even 5 years of an activity, the livelihood has not reached the necessary level of maturity, much like small businesses in developed countries, but made even more difficult because of the climate events and security situation of these fragile countries. So in these circumstances, when the funding abruptly stops at the end of the said project, as it often happens, the results won't be sustainable, and this is deplorable. And often also the experts leading the project undertake some other project and leave the country or the organization, and the new representatives coming are not really aware of the situation in the community. So I would emphasize how the role of local implementing partners is essential for the continuity, and also insist on better coordination with other organizations or funding partners to ensure the sustainability of the results.
Jessica, what role should be given to Haitians to drive this agenda forward?
Thank you for this question. I think this is a really, really important question. So I think what's really, really crucial is that Haitians that are most impacted by climate change, those that are in positions of vulnerability, are the ones that are the experts. And in that position where they are the experts, they are the ones that know their experience, they know their respective communities, and should be the ones absolutely leading in this. And that means they understand the dynamics of their community and their society in general. And I think real engagement is necessary for any of this, the addressing of climate change, to be sustainable. Haitians absolutely have to be leading and very localized. So they need to be from the communities in which we're trying to impact.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for all three of you for taking the time to have this conversation on climate peace and security in Haiti, and especially these kinds of forward-looking next steps. We have discussed how so many different actors, from civil society to UN agencies, international organizations, and government, have come together in this notably fast process of realizing the study and create a foundation that leads to the implementation of these recommendations. We've been lucky enough to really take a deep dive and look at some of the rare insights on the technicalities of how to create a study with direct and concrete impact. We've taken a deeper look at the main pathways of climate and insecurity in Haiti, from climate change harming social cohesion to increasing the vulnerability of young people. We've discussed recommendations like decentralizing responses and empowering local communities, the importance of giving Haitians and Haitian civil society the active role to drive this agenda forward has been emphasized, since they are the experts on their experiences, their communities, and on potential solutions going forward. Everything the three of you have shared has been exceptionally insightful. So thank you so much. This was the Climate Diplomacy Podcast. We will be back with another episode in a few weeks. You can follow our latest updates on Twitter at Climate Diplo. And thank you so much for tuning in. And thank you so much for our guest for this week. And until next time, goodbye. Thank you.